This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, yes, we're going to do this again, The God Show. And what is it now that he has in mind, this little Pat McMahon guy who is saying every single time that you tune in to the Star Worldwide Networks, I want you to be surprised. I want you to at least for a moment say, you know what, that one I didn't expect. Because I hope that every time we all get together, wherever you are in the world, that there are surprises, and at the end of the hour you can say, I'm glad I listened to that because I didn't know that. And I particularly am fond when we have a guest that is truly a world traveler. Dr. Bjorn Krondorfer is a gentleman who's a Regents Professor, director of the Martin Springer Institute at Northern Arizona University. He received his doctorate at Temple in Philadelphia, but Philadelphia and Flagstaff, Arizona, certainly don't represent the world travels that he's been a part of. Armenia, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Canada, Finland, Germany, Italy, Israel, and Palestine, along with Poland, South Africa, South Korea, Switzerland, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And so I'm going to ask you, before we actually get into all of the difficulties that people have in understanding Israeli-Palestinian relations, before any of that, having traveled, Dr. Krondorfer, I'm going to ask you something I would ask you in my living room if we were sitting, looking at one another, and just having a good chat. If you wanted to spend the rest of your life in one of those places that is not in the United States, that is not Flagstaff, Arizona, where would it be? The rest of your life, Dr. Krondorfer has found a home. Where?
If it would not be Flagstaff and in the United States, oh, that is a tough one. I sometimes joke that if I get the same professional opportunity that I have here at Northern Arizona University and at the Martin Springer Institute, I might choose Berlin, Germany. I do have German roots. I was born there, but that's actually not so much the reason. But Berlin is a wonderful metropolitan city where you find cultural life and all the colors and flavors and conflicts of different ethnic communities at this point. So that's probably where I would go. But I have to say, when I came 9 years ago to Flagstaff, Arizona to work at the university, I really have come to like Flagstaff very much. So I doubt that I will move.
Well, good for us and good for you. As I mentioned in your travels academically, part of your professional life has been spent in Israel and Palestine, both. You were teaching in both areas, were you not?
Well, if by teaching we mean traditional education, no. But I have been invited several times to work as a facilitator, kind of a mediator facilitator for bringing together Palestinians and Israelis and sometimes an additional group, Germans, and sometimes without, to find a way to lessen the mistrust and distrust and hostile feelings and possibly misinformations about each other, to find a new pathway for, neighborly relations that are positive and not just burdened by the current conflicts and by past conflicts. It's tough work, but that's why I've traveled there a number of times. I'm also working sometimes with Ben Gurion University in Be'er Sheva on programs with students from our university and their university. So there are multiple ways how I connect to this part of the world.
But connecting the people of Israel with the people of Palestine has seemed to have been an impossible effort on the part of diplomats and presidents. We recently had a ceasefire called. It seems to be somewhat loose in its interpretation and the definition of ceasefire. Are you optimistic that this will hold for any period of time at all, Dr. Krondorfer?
Well, that's a good question, simply because it seems like we have been there before. In 2014, we had a similar military conflict and war between Gaza and Israel in the summer of 2014, and actually went over during the summer to work with Israelis and Palestinians while the war was going on. And at the time, we asked ourselves the same questions. Is this the last time? Is something else happening? And we had both positive and negative assessments. Some people thinking optimistically, maybe this was the last hurrah of Hamas and Israeli military forces to have this exchange of weaponry with so many dead people on both sides, more in Gaza. And now, you know, 7 years later, we're at exactly the same moment. And I would say most people probably in Israel and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip probably think the same. This was another round and it will be silent for a few years and it might return the same way unless both the population and politicians, and maybe with the help of the international community, they will actually find a different way to figure out how to live side by side.
But what is that different way, Doctor? What is that different way that has seemingly eluded the international community, the United Nations, powers like the United States, with responsible parties involved on every side, and then finally facing failure? Why?
Yeah, that. So people who give it some thought in writing and in research talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as either an intractable conflict, which means it is so unsolvable that no one knows when it will end. And some people are calling it a protracted conflict, which says it has been going on for a long time, but there will be an end at some point. Now, what you do not really want to happen is the end means like the end of one of the two sides, say, the worst-case scenario, which I don't think is likely to happen, but say the expulsion of all Palestinians from the remaining Palestinian territories, or a victory of Palestinians with maybe in coalition with Arab forces that kind of puts the state of Israel on its brink, to its knees, and people think that the only way to survive would be leaving. Now, these were the two nightmare scenarios. I don't think they're going to happen. So we need new ideas that go beyond the two-state solution that has been put out in public discourse and among politicians and diplomats and pundits and opinion makers, that the two-state solution is the only way forward. But this has been discussed and in the debate for more than 20 years. It seems at this point this is not a viable solution, and more people begin to agree that this perhaps the two-state solution, meaning a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, both independent side by side. That is what the two-state solution means. That perhaps is no longer a viable option given the reality on the ground. So people begin to think about federacies or a one-state solution with equal rights among all the different minority populations. We'll see. I mean, it's hard to tell right now.
is the foundation of the difficulty, the lack of understanding of the other side, the communication difficulties, all of those things. Is it primarily religious, geographic, political, or something else?
I would say, and which makes it so complicated, I would say there are three main reasons why there is this conflict, and also why we as a world community pay so much attention to it. And I might return to this later about the paying much attention to it, because in terms of the degree of violence and the number of casualties, there are other conflicts in this world that are far worse than what is happening between Israel and Palestinians. But they get far less attention from the general public unless you live in that region itself. So we might want to come back to this. But why is it such a long, simmering, seemingly unsolvable conflict? I'd say it has three major reasons. One is religious and has to do with Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a holy city for three different religious traditions, and I'm sure many of our listeners know this, both for Judaism, because it's the temple, the holy temple that was destroyed in the year 70 CE by the Roman Empire, which forced Jews into exile, and they didn't return until 1948. For Christians, because of Jesus Christos, the Messiah, the death of Jesus in Jerusalem, and for Islam, because of Muhammad, who kind of was transported to Jerusalem and from there ascended to the heavens, according to Quran and Hadith literature, where he talked to God and then returned and established the second pillar of Islam, the prayers that are so essential. So Jerusalem is a holy place for three different religions. We can call them sibling religions, but they have been in conflict, unfortunately. So that's the one source why it's so significant to so many people. The second, I would say, is political and geographic. The two terms that you mentioned, it has to do with the destruction, decline of the last Muslim empire, the Ottoman Empire, which was mainly based in Istanbul, in today's Turkey. It fell apart after World War One, and the last Muslim empire under the Ottomans became a Turkish secular nation state, and the rest of the empire was carved out by the colonial powers of Britain and France. So we have the geopolitical tensions built into this conflict, and what is today Palestine and Israel became part of the British Empire, part of the British Mandate. And I think the third one actually is the Holocaust. And since I'm directing here an institute that was founded by a Holocaust survivor from Poland who became a resident of Flagstaff, that obviously is very dear to my own research and heart as someone who was born in Germany. And the Holocaust kind of accelerated and probably made possible the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 for two reasons. One is the remaining population in the remaining Jewish population who survived the Nazi genocide went basically to two or three places mostly. One was Israel, or what became Israel, and then United States and Canada and a few other places. And second, because the international community was ready to account for and reckon with the anti-Semitism in Europe, which turned into the genocide, namely the Holocaust, and make possible an independent nation state for Jews. And that became the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. So these three things combined make it such a tough conflict because there's so much history and historical memory involved by both Palestinians and Jews, but also people are implicated because of their religious aspirations and visions that tie them back to Jerusalem.
And there are many who argue the point that scripturally God himself intended Israel to be an independent nation not as a neighbor or a separate entity that had a relationship with Palestine, that God intended the Holy Land to be Jewish and Israel. And how do you argue with the Bible?
Well, you always a good question. The Bible always have lots of material to argue with, internally and externally. So yes, for one, I mean, traditionally in biblical Judaism, before it became Talmudic Judaism, this change roughly in the first, second century, is that traditionally the presence of God was in the temple, on the Temple Mount, which today is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So now the Temple Mount itself has a mosque there simply because Islam ruled Jerusalem for several centuries. But that's the old Jewish Temple Mount, and the presence of God was in the temple. Now, with the Roman destruction of the temple, the tabernacle, it was lost. And one of the traditional religious interpretation in Judaism is that God went into exile with his people. So as the Jewish peoples during Roman Empire were kind of left to move to different parts of Europe and North Africa because they no longer had a kingdom, they felt like, well, God is gone, we are gone from our sacred lands, and so God is going with us into exile. And ever since the last 2,000 years, this deep yearning among religious Jews to one day to go back to the promised land, to Israel. Now where it becomes more complicated and political is that many, and I probably would say most Jews would say, or at least traditional, in the tradition of Judaism, the idea was we will return one day to Israel, but when we return, this will be the beginning of the Messianic Age.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot be determined by humans. That is in the will of the divine. And many Jews feel have a complicated relationship, like whether or not this is the moment with the creation of the State of Israel, or whether it's just a political entity, a secular political nation that actually has nothing to do with the religious visions of where we will be when the Messiah comes or the Messianic Age breaks in. So that's why we have in Israel, you know, both very, very religious Jews, which people call the ultra-Orthodox community, the Haredim, and most people in Israel are actually secular. They don't have particular strong religious feelings about the place, but they feel that it's their secure place.
More conservative and reform expressions of Judaism than the Orthodoxy, right?
Yeah, reform and conservative forms of Judaism, they definitely have an affiliation, a strong emotional affiliation to the State of Israel, but not so much because of religious reasons, but because of this being their home place, a secure place that if things go wrong where they are currently living, they know they can go to a place that is safe and secure, which Jews as a community didn't have for the last 2,000 years. So it's really special for the Jewish community. And at the same time, the place, as I said before, is really special to Muslims and is very special to Christians. So, and it's hard to, apparently, it is very hard for the three religious communities to share this place peacefully because there's so many historical events, some and many of them traumatic events, and also religious aspirations attached to this place.
Is part of the resentment of Palestinians, and particularly those who historically have been in that area of the West Bank and Gaza for years and years and years, is part of the resentment, the kind of resentment that would be felt, and I say this without any intent to simplify the act in 1948 of an international organization like the United Nations saying, this is now an area that the world will recognize independently as the nation of Israel. But isn't it a little bit like the United Nations saying, for whatever purpose, we're taking Wyoming and we're giving it to this group of people who have been homeless over the decades and the centuries, and we've decided they need a home. It used to be Wyoming, now we're going to call it Israel.
Yes, to some extent that is true, and that, of course, is the grievance of Palestinians, and I would say the rightful grievance for Palestinians, while at the same time I would say it's rightful for Jews to have a homeland, to have a nation in which they feel secure, which makes it so difficult from outside to quickly judge one over the other group, but to kind of hold both of the groups and both of the grievances and aspirations at the same time. Yes, for Palestinians, it's very hard. I mean, they lost their land, they lost their, to some extent, their tradition, if it was bound to a particular locality, they lost their vineyards and they lost their, you know, olive trees, and saw suddenly a modern Israel being built out of nothing in so many ways in their old villages. Now, in fairness to the international community, there was a plan to divide the country roughly from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, which borders to Jordania, the country of Jordan, and to divide not quite equally, but somewhat equally in terms of landmass between Palestinian territory, which was supposed to be self-ruled, and Israeli territory. And then over the course of, since 1948, over the last, 70 years now, we had several military conflicts and wars, and the original intention changed. Many of the Palestinian leaders didn't accept the UN plan, maybe because what you just said, you know, who voluntarily gives up a piece of territory that you think is yours? No one does. In no war, anyone is voluntarily giving up any territory. And so, yeah, by now, when I work with Israelis and Palestinians in these group settings, and by group settings, this means we are minimally we're staying together 3 days, nonstop, sometimes longer, and just to not only talk, but kind of explore options and possibilities. So by now, after 70 years, we really can talk about two traumatic moments that play against each other. The trauma for the Jewish people, the Jewish Israelis, is of course rooted in the Holocaust. And the promise to themselves that this will never ever happen to them again, at least not without a fight, this kind of genocidal anti-Semitism. And on the Palestinian side, the expulsion from their hometowns, which are now Israel, which is in Arabic called al-Nakba, the Nakba, the great catastrophe, which kind of is transmitted in their generational memory from children to grandchildren and to from one generation to the next, basically, as a loss that they grieve over, and knowing that realistically they won't return to these places. In many ways, they don't really exist anymore. They're modern towns now. But it's a cultural memory that feeds much of the resentment and the grief that the Palestinians feel. And so, minimally, we try to get each of the groups, when I work with them, to recognize the trauma of the other group, rather than have them cancel out the other person's trauma because of your trauma. to try to recognize and let both of them stand equally in the room. And that is not easy. For some Palestinians to recognize the full extent of the Holocaust is sometimes difficult. And for many Israelis, it's difficult to even say the word Nakba and acknowledge Nakba, because many Israelis don't. And sometimes if you just even mention the word, it seems like you already positioned yourself politically when you just try to acknowledge different people's pains and griefs.
Dr. Krondorfer is from NAU, at least for the last 9 years, is it, Bjorn? 9 years at NAU. The people who are fortunate enough to be able to understand elements of the Holocaust and those events in history that preceded it and those that have followed it are fortunate to have a faculty member like Dr. Krondorfer, who was a student of so many facets of this most confusing part of the world. Within just the last few weeks, again, if I brought up the terrible responses that took place, the faculty, the people who live in and around the cities of what at least most people think of as Palestine, the destruction that was a part of the recent response by the Israeli military. But the Jewish people continued to say, as they have for years, there wouldn't have been a response, there wouldn't have been those fatalities, but for the rockets that fell on Israel. Yes, most of them were stopped because of the defense system that Israel employs. But still, regardless, there was that initial attack, not just by Palestinians, but by a political entity called Hamas. Would you take it from there, please, Dr. Krondorfer?
Sure. So for those who are not completely familiar with the geography, what we call today Palestine are really two separate strips of land. One is along the Jordan River, and that is the so-called the West Bank, and that is where most Palestinians live, but it's now many of their places within the West Bank, which was supposed to become an independent Palestinian state, has now sees lots of Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers occupying these lands and kind of carving out enclaves for Jews within the proper Palestinian territory of that's called the West Bank. And we can come back to why that is. Gaza is different. It sits at the Mediterranean Sea. It's actually fairly a small piece of land. It's only 25 miles long. It's only 140 square miles. If you compare it to New York City, New York City is 302 square miles. So you're talking about a small piece of land.
Yes.
Which is only for Palestinians because Israel agreed to return all of it to Palestinians in 2005 it was. And Israel had some places. Israelis were living in that country, which is now the Gaza Strip, and they moved out. So Hamas is a Muslim political organization. They won the free elections in 2006 against another Palestinian party, and they have ruled ever since. And they have a policy of not accepting the status quo as it is, and they hope that by showing some military might against Israel, they would at least score some political points. I think they know very well militarily they cannot win. So they're not shooting this rockets because I think they can win a military war. I think they want to win a ideological or political war by doing so. And it's unfortunate because in the end, the people who suffer are civilians. The rockets fired from Hamas in Gaza to towards Israeli territory, they have a longer reach now than they used to, but they're still fairly crude rockets. They're not precision rockets. They can't tell their rockets exactly where to go. Israel obviously has very precision weaponry. They know exactly what buildings they want to destroy, and they destroy those buildings. You know, it's not random in that sense. So it's an uneven military exchange, which is why most people think this is more politically motivated than motivated, because people think it could be military success.
But what possible benefit could Hamas or any of the people politically who were religiously or emotionally or politically on the side of the Palestinians, what possible benefit could there be in Hamas, as crude as their weaponry is, attacking a highly sophisticated military like Israel?
Well, you know, I mentioned two reasons that come to mind. One is to show that they truly are representing the interests of all Palestinians, including the Palestinians in the West Bank, separated from the Gaza Strip, which is ruled by different Palestinian party and organization, Fatah, it's called. To say, like, you know, Fatah is lame, they are not doing much, they are cooperating too much with the Israeli government. We stand for a true Palestinian nationalist identity, hoping to unite all Palestinians again. That probably is one message. And the other message is probably to the international community, that to have the international community pay attention to the plight of Palestinians in Gaza, because it's not easy living there. They're shut out. They're surrounded by a fence. They cannot cross the fence without permission. They cannot cross the Mediterranean. They can go out so far. I don't know how many miles it is that they go fishing within the Mediterranean, but then they are cut off by Israeli patrols. So they're pretty much in a, you could say in a way, they're pretty much in a huge prison in a certain way, because there's no freedom of movement, and everything, all the goods that go in and out are completely controlled by both Egypt and Israel. So it is hard. It is just simply really hard to live in Gaza and have an enjoyable life. And they don't want to be forgotten. So And sure enough, they did get the attention of the international community.
When I visited Israel, I was really surprised, Dr. Krondorfer, at the number of Palestinians who work there and participate in virtually all of the facets of the community. And that still continues, doesn't it?
It does. We also need to pay attention to a third group of Palestinians, and these are Palestinians that are called Arab Israelis, but they're really Palestinians, which means they are Palestinians who live inside of Israel and have Israeli citizenship. And there's actually a very high number of them, and in certain towns they're the majority of the population within Israel. So we have like the West Bank Palestinian identity, the Hamas Palestinian identity, and then the Arab Israelis in Israel themselves. What was new in this conflict, and tragically new in this conflict, is not that rockets were fired from Hamas into whatever, random targets, and that usually means civilians get hit in Israel, and then the military responds, but that Arab Israelis and Jewish Israelis were fighting on the streets for the first time inside Israel. Mm. And that really shocked everyone, including Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. that he immediately started to actually go after both the Jewish Israeli radicals and the Arab youth that were really upset, and they were fighting each other. They were firebombing synagogues, and they were firebombing each other's holy places and beating people up. And I say that was so unfortunate because for the Jewish population, what that triggers is the you could say the long-standing trauma of pogroms that the Jewish community experienced again and again and again throughout the Middle Ages into the 20th century, obviously not by Arabs, but by Europeans, you know, by Russians, the Ukrainians, and Germans, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So this neighbor-to-neighbor violence, this form of intimate violence, suddenly you can't trust your neighbor, that triggers such a strong response among Jews with the historical memory of, yeah, we've been there before. Suddenly our neighbors turn against us. And so it's to me, that's the most unfortunate moment in the current conflagration between Palestinians and Israelis. And that is new, and it's been shocking for many people.
Netanyahu's position of leadership in Israel is considered by many people to be shakier, far less solid and assured than it ever has been since he's taken power. He had a very difficult time establishing an additional period of time in which his party, the Likud party, would be in power in the Knesset, in their parliament. But if Netanyahu leaves office, having spent as much time there talking to Israelis and Palestinians alike, what then, Dr. Krohndorfer? Dramatic changes or much of the same?
Well, again, depends who you ask and where you are on the political spectrum. You will hear different answers regarding Netanyahu's rule and government style. He has been controversial for quite some time. He's also accused of some bribery schemes, and we don't know whether that ends up haunting him in the court system. I always think, and that has nothing to do with him personally, that for democracies, it is good if there is leadership change every few years. Every few years could be 8 years or whatever it is, but simply because with the leadership change, you may actually entertain new ideas that you didn't consider before. It's going to be very complicated in Israel because the Israeli political landscape is so diversified and in tension and conflict with each other with lots of parties. You know, if you complain in America that we only have a two-party system, in Israel, you would have to complain that you have a system that has too many small parties who suddenly get too much power because you just need these two or three voices or seats to make a coalition, and then they get extraordinary decision-making power, even though they don't really represent much of the population. So that's what's tough in Israeli politics right now. No one is the majority. No party gets outright the majority. So everyone has to make compromises and coalitions with parties that actually don't agree necessarily with your platform. And that's why for the last 2 years it has been incredibly difficult to find a stable government in Israel.
You wrote a publication called Unsettling Empathy, Working with Groups in Conflict. I can't think of two groups that more totally epitomize the concept of conflict politically, religiously, socially than these two groups that we're talking about now. Have you found in your many years as an academic dealing with conflict as you have, are there some conflicts that are simply unresolvable?
Well, they seem unresolvable during our lifetimes. And I think we need to remember that our lifetimes are short. The lifetime of structures, nations, communities are longer than our personal lifetimes. So if you ask me, would I see in the next two decades during my life a radical change in Israel-Palestine? I would be somewhat skeptical, although I would very much hope to see it. But we know from history, nothing ever stays the same. At some point, something will change. In 1989, before November 9, 1989, in Germany, there was a wall between East and West Germany, between the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union and its allies. And in 1989, without any predictions by anyone, without any major events, the wall between East and West Germany came down. No one was prepared for it. No one saw this coming. And it changed history. You know, it suddenly changed. And the wall, in our mind, we always think a wall is like stable and will always be there. And it's not. And so the wall that divides Israel and Palestine, the wall and the fences, literally and symbolically, they're walls, but there's a literal wall, there's a real wall, that wall won't be there forever. I just cannot predict when it will come down. And my hope, of course, is that whatever Israel and Palestinians agree on will be to find a peaceful solution to learn to become neighbors and accept sporadic violence while being neighbors, because that violence will not suddenly disappear overnight, but still work towards neighborhood while some people will commit violence, unfortunately, rather than, as I started this talk, rather than the worst case scenario that victory is only if one group completely is victorious over the other, and somehow in the Israel-Palestinian conflict would mean like expulsion of some sort of one group against the other.
But in a way, Doctor, they are neighbors without any intention to be neighbors, in that the settlements made up, I think it's very surprising to most Americans if they haven't been there, or they haven't done a great deal of reading, I think they would be surprised that we're talking about not just an apartment building or a neighborhood where the settlements of Israelis are in the midst of the Palestinians, in the midst of those areas that are considered by the Palestinians to be their land, their cities, and their neighborhoods. The settlements and the settlers have moved in to the tune of 350 or 400,000 Israelis.
Correct.
Isn't that the most egregious kind of simply a, you can't do anything about it because we're tougher than you are, and so we're moving in, and that's it. If you don't like it, move out.
Well, that's currently the attitude of a large population of Israelis, who we would call politically on the right, who have this mindset, and some of the settlers are very pragmatic. They're actually more secular, and they just want a cheap place to live, and those settlements offer cheap living. And some are really convinced for religious reasons that these lands in what is now the West Bank are actually the promised land, the biblically promised lands mm-hmm. to Jews by God. Samaria to be one of them. Whereas the coastal cities, which are now firmly in the hands of the modern state of Israel, is actually not of interest to them. To religiously inspired settlers. For them, they think they have a divine mandate to settle the land that was given and promised them by God according to the Torah or the Old Testament, the Bible. If the secular-minded Jews who move there for pragmatic reasons, could they be convinced to move somewhere else if it's advantageous to them? Yes. Those who have religious reasons to be there, it would be much harder, and they would fight even the Israeli government if they were to be expelled by the Israeli government, which happened in Gaza. So there were actually kind of a fight between the Israeli settlers and the Israeli military. And so they're convinced they have a right to be there. That makes it so difficult. And yes, for Palestinians, that is really not acceptable. But that's why people think like a two-state solution is no longer an option, because the communities, at least in the West Bank, between Jews and Arabs are already so intertwined in terms of land, not in terms of access to different places, but in terms of the land, the actual land. It would be so much better to think about, to come up with new ideas of how to think the West Bank and Israel combined as possibly a kind of confederacy where people live next to each other with equal rights. Sounds like a dream, but you know, the two-state solution is as much a dream, because it's not going to be realized, because I don't think the 400,000 people who live in the West, 400,000 Jews who live in the West Bank will leave voluntarily.
It's so incredibly confusing. For us, the other democracy. Here are these two democracies, very different from one another. If you just simply look at the geography alone, this massive continent that is the United States and part of North America, and then this very tiny area geographically that is Israel. And so rather than taking sides politically or religiously, let me ask you about an attitude that a number of people, including a number of Jews, have expressed to me. And that is, they said, no matter what the solution is, one of the first things that you have to do away with is the inherent arrogance of Israelis toward Palestinians. What's your response?
Well, I've seen some ugly scenes when visiting, like attitudes and behaviors, and I've also seen like these amazing moments between Israelis and Palestinians, and they suddenly realize like they actually share more. They have more in common than the political situation allows them to express.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, you know, European Israelis over time became Middle Eastern Israelis. You know, they kind of adopted a different Mediterranean type of culture and living and being, which is actually very close to how Palestinians lived in their own family structures and their love of land. There are actually many commonalities. Is there some arrogance? Absolutely. I've seen it. Is there some polemic hatred among Palestinians who don't think through all the aspects but only see like their particular point of view where they are and driven by the experience that they've had? Absolutely. I mean, you cannot deny that these attitudes exist. And there's hatred of Israelis against Arabs too. I mean, death to the Arabs is a slogan that is often yelled at Palestinians when there is a confrontation between extremists, and death to the Jews just the same. However, the strength, and that is what is missing in politics right now, the strengthening of the middle that is willing to try out something else is not happening on the political side. The political parties in power do not work towards strengthening a center that is willing to try something else. And that is lacking in the current situation. And to some extent, maybe by design, you know, I don't know, I can't look into people's minds, but you would wish that the center is strengthened. because there are definitely enough people who are willing to do this. And Arab Israelis, those Palestinians who live inside Israel, have actually practiced this for several decades. It's only, you know, last 2 weeks, that suddenly there was this extreme outburst of violence between Israeli and Arab, Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis. And that is worrisome, and I hope they get this under control. But I want to mention one thing.
Yes.
To bring it to back to make it less exotic for people who don't know Palestine in Israel, if we go to Arizona, where you and I live, the Dine Nation, the Navajo, for them, the San Francisco Peaks are a sacred mountain. It delineates their territory. It's a sacred mountain. On that sacred mountain, we have a ski lift, you know, for mostly white Americans, or those who can afford to go skiing in the winter.
Yes.
And for Native Americans, that is deeply painful because they feel like their sacred territory is desacralized. There's certain blasphemy, non-recognition that this place means to them something else than just for us using as a ski resort. Do they have the power to change this? No. Do they try through legal routes, which Palestinians often try, through the legal route to kind of claim back some of their lands? They can try. It hasn't been successful. And we, meaning, say, non-native Arizonans, can simply ignore the pain that Native Americans feel about what is happening to their sacred spot. And you can ignore it. And in many ways, these dynamics are similar in Israel. Many Israelis can ignore the Palestinian plight because they live separated from each other. And so we can ignore the plight of Native Americans, the Dine, who feel like this is a sacred place that they would like to get back without being contaminated.
One of the best parallels I've ever heard about these two areas. I've never heard that before, and I thank you for it. I have two minutes till the end of the program, and Dr. Krondorfer, I'd like to know from you, not from the standpoint of wishful thinking, realistically, do you see any dramatic change in the leadership of Israel and the Knesset, their parliament, or Hamas on the other side in the foreseeable future?
I think we will probably see a change in the political coalition in Israel earlier, because at some point Netanyahu is going to step down. And Hamas depends on whether they have enough legitimacy within the population or not. That is a little hard to judge for me. I do hear that the population in the Gaza Strip themselves are discontent with the Hamas rule. They would like to have another open and free election and see what happens. So I think Hamas has a longer staying power in the Gaza than the current Israeli coalition has in Israel.
With that, and only a minute and a half left, I'm going to place a great deal of responsibility on you and your right hand. Snap your finger and come up with the ideal solution for that part of the world.
To seriously trust that there are people on both sides who are actually willing to live next to each other, and strengthen those people and expand the circle of these people and try it out incrementally. I think that would be the best solution I can think of at the current moment.
One of the solutions for me to have a greater understanding of Israeli-Palestinian relations is somehow miraculously for the faculty at Northern Arizona University to provide me entry into a classroom that is taught by Dr. Bjorn Krondorfer on this subject or just about anything you want. This has been The God Show with Pat McMahon.